Yes Live Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly and I'm the host for the show each week. And I'm also founder of the UK charity Yes to Life that's pushing forward the agenda for integrative medicine in the field of cancer. As part and parcel of that objective, each week I speak to key figures involved in integrative medicine, both here in the UK and in many other countries, be they doctors, oncologists, integrative medicine practitioners, scientists or activists. And in that vein, I'm talking today to Victoria Fenton. Victoria is a functional medicine practitioner who specialises in supporting people with cancer, who's a brilliant resource of expertise and experience. I'm talking to Victoria today over the internet on the subject of building health strategies. Victoria, brilliant to have you back on the Yes to Life show.
Hi Robin, it's so lovely to be back.
So today we're going to talk about strategies, and the reason of course that strategies are so important is that finding yourself in entirely unfamiliar territory with no strategy at all is a horrible, horrible experience. In fact, I'd say a carefully put together strategy can throw a bright light in even the darkest situation and provide a way forward at times when on the face of it there appears to be no way forward. Furthermore, I'd say that getting a good strategy when everything is so unfamiliar can appear to be an insurmountable obstacle, but you know, people have shown us time and time again that it is possible. So I'm hoping that spending a bit of time today exploring ways to put a strategy together under challenging circumstances will be a useful exercise. So firstly, knowing a little of the personal health story that brought you to where you are now, I'm guessing that you have found yourself in exactly the kind of situation I've just described. And for those listening lucky enough to have not had to deal with circumstances like this, I wonder if I could start out by asking you about the emotional, psychological and practical challenges involved.
Oh gosh, it's so destabilizing to be chugging along with your normal life and feel like everything is you know, as you planned it, and suddenly you are in a situation where your core trust in your own body, yourself, has been completely eroded, which is what happens when we get health crises, diagnoses of any description. It sort of turns your world on its head. And it's the cost of that is enormous. It is a huge disruptor to flow, basically. And every plan you've ever had feels like it goes out the window immediately. And that level of destabilization actually is a neurological situation. It completely throws the body into what we call fight or flight. Dominance, essentially. And at that moment, effectively, you are panicking. And I personally experienced this myself, but I've also worked with lots of patients who, on the surface, they might think they're not panicking, but underneath the surface, there is this real vibration and chemistry of panic happening within their physiology.
Right.
And as you were alluding to, making plans and strategies at times when the apple cart has been upset, that's why it's almost impossible, because you're in an emergency situation. You're in literally a chemical state where your body is trying to run away from a saber-toothed tiger, effectively. It's really in panic stations, and it's not in slow down, think about the strategy, what's happening sort of second by second. It really is this emotional panic, mental confusion, fog. You know, our brains are not powered to work when we're in sympathetic mode. So it's a huge change in our state, and it really does send chaos through our physiology as well as just seemingly in our lives.
It's a sort of dichotomy, isn't it? Because in fact, you don't really need the fight or flight thing really at all, do you, in this situation? You actually need the sitting down and thinking about it carefully and doing some planning, getting a strategy.
100%, yeah. And unfortunately, our bodies don't know that.
No.
You know, they just have been handed a trauma, effectively.
Yeah.
And I do think we need to start within healthcare understanding that getting a diagnosis particularly a surprising diagnosis, is a huge trauma.
Right.
Sometimes it's a relief. Sometimes it gives us an explanation for how we've been feeling. And sometimes the emotional impact of answers is enormous. But it's always a trauma. It's always a shock, effectively. And our shock physiology and trauma response kicks in. So, yes, at the very time when we need calm, rational,
right.
Slow down and breathe, our physiology is not built to do that.
Mm-hmm. So, out of interest, how did you go about building a plan to get yourself out of the corner you were in?
Oh, I don't think I'm a model for that. I think the reason I do what I do is because I made all the mistakes. And I really do hold my hand up to that. You know, when I first became ill, I spent a lot of time, and I was 17 at the time, so I was very young comparatively.
Right.
And the world wasn't what it was. We're talking 2004. So it's a long time ago. And it was very much, there was no help. There was no... there wasn't the interest in self-advocacy in healthcare at all. And so I did all the consulting, all the doctors and getting less and less and less help as I went along. And then made all the mistakes, tried all the wrong things, panicked in all the wrong ways. And a big part of why I do what I do is because I know I did it wrong. And I know that had my emotional state and all of my, trauma triggers not been so pushed, I may have got answers and solutions and resolution a lot more quickly than I actually did.
Mm.
So my goal within my job is to be the person that I would have needed at the time that I got unwell.
Mm. Right.
So yes, I'm not the poster child for effective strategies in my own life.
Right.
But I do build them now for other people to avoid them making my mistakes.
Okay. Well, look, okay, not the poster child, but... nonetheless, it's good to hear a real world example, because that's actually what does happen, of course, particularly when you're that young. So, as you say, since then, you've gone on to help many people develop their own strategies. So what I'd like to do now is look at some of the common scenarios around cancer that so many people around the world are having to face every day, to see if we can help to uncover the first steps forward, to positive steps in the right direction. The most obvious one to start with is the first diagnosis, a massive shock for most people, very likely to turn their world completely upside down, as you said. So what would you say to help with this situation?
So some of this will depend on your personality, and I'll just say that straight up front, because obviously everyone deals with these kinds of things in different ways depending on their conditioning, their personality, etc. But the first, almost the first and most obvious and least helpful thing that I can say is don't panic, even though we'll panic, but it is the more we can do to lighten up that load of sheer terror, the more bandwidth we have to do everything else.
Right.
So almost the first step I take is less thinking about practical steps of strategy or of like, what am I going to do now? It's actually identifying what you need around you in order to achieve anything. So for me, it's very much less about future focus at that moment of first diagnosis. It's actually going, okay, this is going to be hard and I'm going to be rocked and destabilized. What do I need around me in that situation to ensure that when the inevitable happens and I am panicking and, upset and things are going a bit wrong, I have what I need? So almost I take a step back at that point, particularly if patients contact me, either they suspect or beforehand or just when they've got the diagnosis. I don't launch into, literally strategizing.
Right.
For me, it's very much, what is the infrastructure that you're going to need around you almost whatever happens? And a few examples of that will be your tribe. And I use the word tribe because using the word family doesn't always work. People don't always have the family member, but people normally have, it just needs to be one other person, preferably more, but one other confidant, one other person that you don't have to put on a face for.
Right.
And you don't have to blend with. Because we are human beings and we are not designed to do life alone. We're certainly not designed to do deeply stressful experiences alone. We are designed to do those in community. So finding your people is sort of the first step. It's like, okay, I've just been dealt this huge blow. I'm going to need a tribe around me. Let me gather them in. And that can be difficult, you know, confessing this sort of stuff to people, bringing, we have this whole weird thing about burdening other people with our problems and all of those kind of emotions crop up. But I do really think it's valuable to identify your tribe, number one, and then identify your team. And team I class as the medical health professionals that you're going to use. Now, that can be from your oncologist. If you hate your oncologist and you don't get on with them, fine, second opinions, all of those kinds of things. But you find your key figures, whether that's from the medical establishment, the conventional medical establishment, and there's some great doctors out there. And then your other people, whether it's a nutritionist or a functional medicine professional like myself, or whether it's counselors, breathwork coaches, anybody who you feel like you're going to need to bring in to facilitate your balance and healing, that's step two. And it's almost like surrounding yourself with resources is the first step to a strategy from that moment of diagnosis.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, yes, it's something that people will often talk about, getting a kind of team together, but it's not necessarily put in there as the number one thing to do before you do anything else. And I can see the effect that would have on you sort of psychologically and emotionally, just to have that in place.
It's an outsourcing, effectively. So as our brains are formed, we like to know that we can depend on something external to us. And sometimes that's criticized in, you know, like New World self-development stuff. It's like, no, you have to be your own cheerleader and you know, self-love is where it all starts. And that's all true. I'm not going to disagree with that. But when it comes to actually dealing with life, it really is about, you know, being able to relax neurologically because you know you've got other people having your back and on your side, and preferably for the team bit, who've done it before and who've seen it before, and preferably a lot of times. So I've seen all the permutations. And when you get those moments where you don't have an answer to a question, or you don't know the next step, or you don't know what the feeling means and all of those things, you've got somebody to ask those questions of. And even if you never use those people, and I mean that, like there are, when I get people early on in their process, we identify all the key people. Sometimes they are contacted. Other times it's just, well, if this happens, that's the person we're going to go to. And just knowing that you've identified those key links and members of your team and community is relaxing. It enables your being to take a breath and your whole body to just not have to stress for a minute.
So it's interesting. I mean, some of these people you're talking about, you're going to, obviously, because they are people who are sort of kind of confidants or whatever, you can speak to them openly and about your fears and all the rest of it. Other people, it's more like they've been there and therefore they're a resource for the things that are unknown to you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's why, you know, the psychology of selling stuff is so based on reviews and things like that. We like to know people who've done it before. And the thing with all of these diagnoses that are, they're alien to us, but they're not alien to everyone. And it is the worst feeling to feel like you're alone in the world. But knowing that somebody's been there, and it doesn't actually need to be a super success story. I have to say that. It's not that we need role models who've, you know, beat what we've been through and they've come out the other side, although that's obviously useful. But it can just be people who you can say, look, I'm experiencing this really weird random symptom today. Does that make sense to you? And they're like, oh yeah, that happened to me week two as well. All of those sorts of reassuring things that help.
Yeah, makes complete sense. Okay, so another circumstance I'd say is pretty common is that people jump into a treatment understanding very little about what they're getting into, and in a short time they find themselves in a situation where they're experiencing horrible side effects from the treatment, their energy's gone, they're unable to think clearly, an experience rather like being on a sick-making fairground ride that there seems no way of getting off. What sort of plan could you pull together for them? I mean, where would you point them?
Sure. So that, I'll be honest, is when I get most of my patients.
Right.
So a lot of the times the diagnosis itself is such a shock. And you nailed it, absolutely. You know, there is a thing that we just trust people in white coats. So we just literally step into a treatment plan, oftentimes researching it a little bit. Most people will, you know, amateur Google at these moments and just be like, oh, okay, this is definitely a drug. Okay, this is huge. Okay, we're going into this. Mm. And possibly even have found a lot of forums discussing the consequences of treatment. And so then people don't tend to go in totally eyes closed these days. But they go in mentally prepared, but not physically, for what their body then goes through as you start these treatments. And it becomes a very medicalized process. And when the fatigue sets in, which is often the thing that people don't fully anticipate the feeling of, you know, you hear the word fatigue and you're like, oh, I know what that is. That's when I get most of my patients. Because they're casting around for support within that. And ultimately, when it comes to the strategy, that there's sort of two things to say. The first one, and this will be a theme throughout, is talk to other people who've been there. But the second one that I always recommend at this point is judge your own relationship with those kind of forum areas, because there can be a lot of positivity derived from support forums, but there can also be the sort of toxic element of it where it becomes a little bit panicky. It reinforces fear more than it gives you proactive emotional support.
Right.
So that there has to be a balance. And I must stress that that's not just the case with cancer. That is the case with a lot of illness. These forums that we get into, we get into them because we're seeking similarity and, you know, shared experience and the bonding moment that gives us. But it can be reinforcing our panic at times, particularly if somebody's, you know, seemingly having a worse experience. And we never within illness want to get into pain hierarchies. So if somebody seems to be experiencing worse effects, we can devalue our sense of trauma and pain because somebody else is experiencing worse things.
Right.
And that's never a good place to be in mentally. So the major thing that I say as a strategy at this point, when you're kind of launching into treatments, is educate yourself as much as you know is possible within your realm of expertise, but then ask questions of other people. And the benefit right now is that there are a lot of people like me doing this kind of work. Mm-hmm. And we're able to bridge the gap between medical knowledge and the scary oncology terminology, which a lot of it's like stressful, and real human physiology, like what is actually happening inside your body when you're feeling X, Y, and Z. And sometimes just having somebody to take the time to explain biochemical pathways, which you don't have to remember, you don't need to be able to tell anybody else, but just the calming influence of somebody saying, right, look, what you're doing is taking X medication or you're going through X treatment. This is chemically what's happening inside you. And the net result of this is this sensation that you're experiencing. So that's why it's happening. And as human beings, once we understand the why of something, our whole stress and neurological tension around it dissipates significantly.
Absolutely, yeah.
So having that thought is massively helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Yeah, it's curious, isn't it? That you're right. It's that not knowing what on earth's going on thing, which is so stressful, isn't it? And it's actually sort of it's the very bread and butter of cancer treatment. Of course, it's lots of odd little things happening which you've never experienced before, and you don't know whether they're just, well, this is what happens, and you don't need to worry about it, or whether it means something terrible. So it's you know, you're besieged with questions like that about what is going on.
Yes, and the reality is that unless you've been through it, you really, really don't understand it. And I will freely admit, as the professional, when I started working within cancer, there'd be this random stuff coming up in my patients, and I would have to work out whether it was actually supposed to happen or not. And
right,
even when we've done the training, you know, there is that learning curve of, you know, strange dryness symptoms and strange, you know, weird loss of smell and bizarre things where you're like, does this all need reporting? Is this expected? Can somebody just take account of these notes of what's happening for me? Is often something that I get from my patients, because there is this sense that we can't burden the big doctor professionals with these random weirdnesses.
Right.
But
yeah,
like somebody needs to take account and take note of it. Like, what is it? And that is, you know, I spend a lot of time just listening to honor those crazy symptoms that probably a lot of the time don't mean a lot in terms of severity or need to pay attention. They are expected side effects, It doesn't mean they're very nice to go through. It really does mean they are even more destabilizing, and they increase the sense of distrust within your body. The biggest vibration and emotion I get when I think about cancer and the patients that I have and taking people through it is like things take over your body, whether it's you're thinking about the cancer having taken over, taking up space, all of that kind of stuff, or then the treatment and these toxins that were pumping in and taking over the body, or you're having radio. It's all of these kind of like, it becomes a very, your body becomes a very machine-like, medicalized thing where things have taken over you. And that can be extremely uncomfortable to be in mentally, emotionally, as well as all the physical stuff that goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. And that point you made about not burdening the big doctor with the stuff, well, of course, that's based on something very real, which is they've got almost zero time for you. To be coming along with your little symptoms and things, even if you thought you ought to ask them, you're probably not going to fit it in. So to have somebody who actually does the job you described as listening, you know, which is, it's extraordinarily valuable, isn't it? Yeah. Just even if you don't actually do anything about it, at least you've had a chance to tell somebody.
Yes. And then the other thing that happens at this point as well is that when you're dealing with all these complicated physiological experiences, you tend to go to Google at this point. If you've got the energy, you tend to head onto the forums and to Google, and then you find all of these potential other things that you could and possibly should be doing, whether that's nutrition, supplements, treatments, you know, like going into the alternative world, all of this stuff. It's like, and that can be massively confusing.
Yeah.
And within nutrition for cancer, within supplements for cancer, it's a world where a lot of cancer patients try to educate themselves in a discipline that would take somebody like me, you know, at least a year to get my head around. They're trying to do it whilst they're in the middle of treatment.
I know.
Preferably within the end.
Yeah.
It's just like,
I know,
outsource
crazy
or help, because navigating the correct solution is incredibly complicated when you want to try the extreme things. And I do mean the extreme things. This is not don't take a bit of vitamin C. This is, you know, if you're thinking of trying an extreme dietary solution, get a bit of counsel and advice on it. If you're thinking about, you know, maybe you want to take go to a clinic and get an intravenous drip, get advice on it. Always try and recognize that you're in the middle of something, and whether you're right in the center of treatment or you're about to go into it, you're emotionally charged, and then potentially if you're having treatment, you're physically not in the greatest of centered spaces. So always ask somebody for guidance on how to navigate the crazy world that is complementary and adjunct therapies for all of these things, because there's stuff that you can do, but there should never be this complex that you should be doing everything, because that can get very overwhelming.
So it's an interesting balance, I think, isn't it, between the fact that you're not sort of deferring to experts wholesale. You know, it's the role of somebody at the centre of their own treatment decisions is incredibly important. But also you're not reckoning to be an expert over the weekend either. So it's like still staying at the centre of your own treatment choices, but actually outsourcing, as you say, getting a lot of advice and expert opinion to inform those choices.
Absolutely. My job is an educator. I don't tell people what to do. I give people the information that they might not get from just Googling, you know, diet for cancer.
Yeah.
And at that point, as long as I don't think it's medically negligent of me to support their decision, and that's a line that I, as a professional, am trained, it's a decision I'm trained to make, given the situation that's in front of me. But if somebody wants to try something, at that point, it's their body, it is their right to say, this is what I want to try. But my job is to give them all of the reasons why that's positive and potentially beneficial. The potential pitfalls, like the difficulties of these sorts of things, the things we need to bear in mind given their lifestyle or where they live or who they live with. And then we make a practical plan together of, OK, we're trying this thing. How are we going to construct life so that it works? Because the biggest problem with a lot of these additional therapies for cancer is they're a bit exhausting. They take a bit of prep, particularly if you're changing your diet.
Yeah.
And you're exhausted anyway. you need help, or you need a plan, or you need meal delivery services, whatever it is, but we need to get the strategy on board. It's not just saying, oh, I'm going to clear my kitchen cupboard out on a Friday night and start again on Monday with a different diet. It's very much actually understanding, does that fit? Is it the right choice? And how can we do it best so that all of my life complexity is taken into account, not just my cancer diagnosis? Because that's the biggest problem with illnesses like this. The whole world becomes about the cancer.
Right.
And a lot of my work is like convincing them a lot of the time that they're not just their cancer. They're not at all their cancer. Their cancer is something that is happening. And there is life as well. There's other people. There's a world that we have to map around. And judging that balance between focusing on solutions and not making every waking moment about cancer is a difficult one. It's a really challenging thing to nail.
Yeah, the panic that's often driving things along wants to actually make cancer take over the whole screen, doesn't it, really?
And I should say, actually, that's not somebody's mind being silly. That is their nervous system entirely prioritising their survival.
Right.
So we like to think of ourselves as really intelligent human beings. We're really just very simple animals.
Yeah.
And when there is something inside us, a lot of the time, the biggest problem with cancer is that neurologically, our nervous systems, because it's such a disconnected, particularly if we're talking tumor-based cancers, etc.,
yeah,
it's such a disconnected part of our physiology that our brain isn't aware of it,
yeah,
until it's scanned, it's found, some diagnostic procedure's been done. And then suddenly our mind is aware of it, and our mind understands that we didn't identify it ourselves. Something has been sort of growing inside us,
right,
and we don't really know what it is. And mentally, that's quite destabilizing. And
yep,
I'm using that word a lot because it is the major thing that happens.
Yep.
But neurologically, our entire focus goes into focusing on that thing that we couldn't find until a diagnostic procedure's been done.
Mm.
And so, you know, there is the old phrase of, you know, energy goes where attention flows. And all of that's true. But if your nervous system is trying to identify a survival strategy, which is effectively what you're doing, then
yep,
every thought becomes about it. Every waking moment becomes about it neurologically. It's not just the mind being silly or obsessing. It's a neurological focus.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's can we look now at another situation, kind of another place that we know very many people experience the worst kind of empty-handedness is the day their treatment ends. In one move, they go from being on treatment and fully supported in doing that to being discharged, supposedly okay, but actually feeling life will never be the same again, probably horribly fearful of a recurrence and fundamentally ill-equipped for any sort of normal life. So can we look at ways to get a plan together for these circumstances?
Absolutely. And, you know, 50-50-ish between this is also when I get patients, because
right,
exactly what you've just said, being terrified of a recurrence
mm-hmm.
means that you tend to run hell for leather towards all of the healthy practices that you think you were failing at, which is why things happened in the first place. And my biggest first step with every patient that comes to me in that headspace, and the recommendation I have for people who are at that point of like just being out of treatment, is stop.
Right.
Literally stop, take a major deep breath and understand that emotionally processing the fact that you had cancer is probably the most important next step. And it's the one that everybody misses.
Right.
It's the one that people don't really understand is a necessary step, because they kind of go from cancer, terrible, we'll process it, we're in emergency status, and now we're out and we're technically quote unquote fine. Now we need to stop happening again.
Hmm.
And what doesn't happen in that moment is that I need to actually just emotionally understand that I've just been through a mini version of hell. And every decision that you make without having gone through a bit of trauma processing about that will come from a panic, fear-based angle.
Right.
And that's never a good place to make decisions and choices from. So whenever I get somebody who comes to me in that space, my first consultation with them is not let's think of the greatest nutritional strategy and let's supplement you and let's do a bit of detox because this might be a bit of a toxic process that you've just been through. It's not that. It's literally a coaching session, if not several, to emotionally process all of the unthought thoughts and unspoken feelings and unresolved internal dilemmas that they haven't been able to deal with because they've had cancer for the last however long it's been.
Interesting.
And I really do stress that it is fundamental to not make future decisions based on fear. And I'm just adamant about that universally, whatever condition I'm dealing with. It's not healthy to make decisions based on fear, particularly fear of, you know, gosh, what if it happens again? And the thing with cancer is there's a lot of, God, I never noticed first time round, therefore what happens if I don't notice again?
Wow, that's a very good rule of thumb.
Yeah, and ultimately the things that I might have said when they first came to me might be exactly the same once we've done that little bit of processing. But if you're entering into a quote-unquote health regime based on a fear-based response that you don't want to go back to wherever you've just been in terms of cancer, the whole energy behind it's wrong. The whole kind of, it just creates such friction and conflict, because if I say, you know, it would be a really good idea to follow X diet, as soon as you do something that's slightly off that diet, you're panicking because you're like, oh my God, I'm going to be back at, you know, having cancer again. And the reality with cancer is that, you know, and I'm always going to talk about nutrition and supplements and that kind of stuff because that's my job, but this isn't just, it's not, you don't get cancer because you've eaten wrongly or behaved wrongly for the majority of the time. There is a lot behind cancer that is causal, and it's very, very rarely that it is singularly to do with one lifestyle choice.
Right.
Which means that then making all these decisions about nutrition and lifestyle, they're not insurance policies against ever having cancer again. Mm-hmm. But what I try and coach my patients to get into the mindset of is that the healthiest you can be is your insurance policy about everything. And if we can make your future not about, oh gosh, just not getting cancer again, but actually this pledge to really nurture your being, not just your body, your whole being, emotionally, spiritually, in terms of friendships, connections, and physically, then you are the healthiest you can possibly be. And at that point, if, hopefully this never happens, but if cancer does come back to your doorstep again, you are so much more centered emotionally, physically, mentally. You're in such a much better balanced place that you have way more bandwidth to deal with things. And that's the approach that I take, because it then doesn't build any kind of policies based on running around avoiding the potential of cancer again.
Interesting. It's a very different focus. As soon as you said it, you know, the change between the driving force being not to get cancer again to being as healthy as you can, it's like it's completely different, isn't it?
It's huge. And I'm not saying that anybody ever gets completely to the space where they're mentally, you know, not thinking about cancer. But the more that we can do to, you know, just lighten our load of fears and traumas and all of this kind of panic stuff, literally the healthier we will be. And I genuinely come from the belief within all my work that the least stress you can put through your system, the healthier you will be. And stress in the broadest sense of the word. So, you know, nutritional stress, toxin stress, chemical stress, emotional stress, mental stress, life's, all of those things are stressors. So if you're trying to build a whole life based on the core fear, you're literally starting from a point of stress. And that's never going to be a place that has strong foundations.
Right. Makes complete sense. Okay, well, you've mentioned recurrence a few times. That's a situation you wouldn't wish on anyone. But I wanted to just look at two variations, if you like. You've got, firstly, someone who's simply been down the conventional treatment route. They've done everything. They've been told they're fine. 9 months later, they find themselves back at the hospital with symptoms, having investigations. Now, they're in a situation where the treatment that they trusted to get them well hasn't worked, and they're probably being offered some more. What would you say to them at that point to build a strategy for genuine success?
Do your research is the first thing. And that is sort of contradicting what I've just said. And I don't actually mean independent research. I just mean the issue with trust in healthcare is huge. So the fact that we've trusted a treatment or trusted a doctor, and oftentimes people will end up back at the same doctor with the same treatment or, you know, a slight tweak to it or something different, slightly different being recommended. But we're automatically in a default place of distrust. So everything that you need to do at that point is build up your trust again. Mm. And being, you know, I have a bias here and I will sit in my bias, which will be if you've tried it one way, it's not necessarily try it a different way, but look at what else might be out there in terms of treatments, in terms of the more holistic support, in terms of adjunct therapies. Speak to a second doctor as well. I think a lot of people have a lot of fear about saying to a doctor, I just want to get a second opinion. I never have fear about referring my patients to a second functional medicine, integrative medicine specialist, because we've all had different experience in clinics, which means that we've all seen different things and have different lenses with which we view things.
Right.
So it's never a shame to just say, do you know what? And we all tend to think it's an emergency when stuff like this happens.
Yeah.
But the reality is that most often a week or two is not going to make a massive amount of difference. And at that point, you've got just the bandwidth to, you know, call a functional medicine clinic and just say, wonder if you could have a conversation with me because I'm going down this road again. You've got the time to say, I just want to speak to another specialist to see if there's a different drug or there's a different option or just discuss the potentials of other things. And, you know, it's the other thing to say is it's not a failure if something comes back. You know, doctors aren't God, drugs aren't miracles. We try the best we can. I genuinely believe that there is no willfulness to harm within any healthcare professional. Sometimes things don't work, and sometimes, you know, treatment options that I choose in a functional medicine way just don't, they're not impactful on that human being. And we are more mortified than the patients a lot of the times when the choices that we've made don't fully pay off.
Right.
But we are always willing to try again and to help and to try and think creatively when we've exhausted one potential avenue. And not getting into the psychology of failure or didn't work or distrust is the more you can do to guard against falling into that kind of mentality of failure, the better.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, look, the other scenario I want to look at is like the first one, but amplified by 10, which is the person who did everything that they thought was right to, you know, mm-hmm. across the board, and there they are back with a recurrence. That's a very difficult situation to face. How do you get a strategy there?
It is very difficult. As somebody who works with a lot of people who consult me right at the end of this process, and I get a lot of people who've got technically incurable situations. The mentality behind it can be very negative, particularly when you've thrown everything at it, including money. You know, when you do everything, there is a financial implication to it too. And the biggest thing that I like to stress to people is that you have not failed. As a human being, you have not failed. There is a complex reality occurring within your physiology, and the strategies you've tried didn't work on this occasion. But the reality is that nobody's tried absolutely everything.
Right.
They say they've tried everything, but nobody has.
That's true. And
there is a definite shift I make at that point to the more weird and wonderful. I never lose my foot in kind of proper treatment, oncology, conventional medicine. But at that point, I'm like, let's do some deep spiritually seeking approaches on this. Is there something ancestral healing that we need to do? And I span the whole gamut because I think that within medicine and healthcare, we know a lot, but we don't know absolutely everything. Energy medicine is huge. There's all of these other things that we can look at. And as long as we are, you know, moving the needle towards feeling better all of the time within ourselves, emotionally, you know, physically as well, preferably, we're always working in the right direction. So when you feel like you've tried everything, actually, I missed a step. The first step is allow yourself to feel all of that despair.
Right.
Because if you don't process that despair of I tried absolutely everything and it didn't work, it's a huge unfelt feeling. And that this is probably something that I should have said right at the beginning. What I'm doing is giving tips for how to process out of an emotional situation. First step to all of them is feel the the complete despair and pain within the situation, and then use these strategies to process out of them. It's really important that we do every step and don't just try and hop, skip and jump over the pain. So yes, allow yourself to truly feel that, oh my God, I tried everything, and shout and yell and break plates. It helps, you know, probably not the best china, but you know, just all of the things that you want to do because you're frustrated and angry, don't hold that inside you, because it has a metabolic consequence, hormonal consequence, which can lead to increased, you know, actually cancers can grow out of unprocessed anger. So honestly, feel all the feelings, take a moment, and then regroup and feel free to do the experimental stuff, do the more adventurous things, always, always bearing in mind that somebody should be overseeing and supporting that. And I do that a lot. So lots of, you know, patients want to do mushroom trips and things like that at this point. And you're just like, well, okay, but we're not going to do that in place of every, you know, common sense strategy physically.
Right.
But there's huge healings that can happen from really surrendering to the spiritual nature of the human experience.
Hmm. Well, interesting you bring that in there. I mean, I think you're absolutely right, is that somebody who thinks they've done everything could maybe have not examined their fundamental relationship to life and not found out that their will to be here wasn't that strong. There was something fundamentally in the way that was making them feel unworthy to be here or something, you know, which, of course, the effects of that are kind of unknown, but they certainly exist. Mm-hmm. I think there's no doubt about it. The effects exist. And for some people, they seem to have been enormous.
I struggle, and I freely admit that I struggle to talk about this level of health with people, particularly when there is a diagnosis such as cancer, which has been, you know, it's been promoted a lot. Promote is the wrong word. It's been publicized a lot. Let's use that word. And there's a lot of fear around it. And to start saying, well, maybe your relationship to life wasn't correct or wasn't on point, it feels judgy. It feels judgmental from somebody like me. But I take a step back at that point and say to my patients, look, I've got a really legitimate list of diagnoses that happened to me. I can detail the science of my experience. I can tell you body biochemistry, exactly what happened. That's layer one of what happened to me at 17, which is how old I was when I got unwell. The deeper layer of that is that I was not living my actual life. I was faking my reality. I was, you know, just performing all the time.
Yeah.
And my body was suffering the consequences of that and broke, seriously broke. And yes, I've got, you know, genetic conditions and labels and diagnoses, and I can bore people to death with the practicalities of it.
Yeah.
But at its core essence, the only reason my system went wrong is because I was not running my physiology right. You know, I was not in tune with who I was here to be on any level. And that's, I don't have any shame about that. I was doing what I thought was right and, you know, operating from my wounding patterns and all that kind of stuff. And I don't think any illness is any different than that. Oftentimes it is actually, and it's challenging to get to this place psychologically, but illness is often an opportunity to correct our frequency on some level, whether it's our relationship to our own body, our relationship to our identity, our who we are in this life, how we're showing up, or literally our relationship to other people, or to the world as a whole. It is, you know, all of that inner work is so supremely valuable, and can actually work miracles. You know, when I'm doing my job, yes, a supplement can help here and there, but the stuff that works miracles is allowing people to feel like they've facilitated on a journey of healing, inner healing, more than, you know, additive external healing.
Very interesting. Okay, so we've not got so much time left. I want to try and squeeze in one more scenario for strategizing. Many people these days have had cancer run right through their families like the sort of grim reaper, causing the most devastating losses. And I imagine it can be quite easy to feel fatalistic about one's own chances. Can we talk about getting a strategy to counter what may seem like the inevitable?
It's difficult. It's difficult because there is this, genetic thought process now, and people oftentimes even seek the genetic test so they can work out whether they carry the gene for this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
Reality is that just because things are common doesn't mean they're normal. And cancer is a complex progression in everybody. Even if it's hormonally driven, even if it's, there's genetic components to it, the only way to deal with that is a strategy, is actually psychologically. It's not thinking that if you just eat right, supplement right, sleep right, do everything right, you'll be healthy. Because that, again, you can hear the way I say these things. They're strategies built on tension, not like flow and health, basically. So actually, there's two ways to think about it. One is nothing's inevitable, absolutely nothing. There's three ways. Nothing is inevitable. Two, if it is going through the linear, the family lineage, particularly female family lineage, there's a lot of potential for ancestral healing within that, because the cancers, the female hormone-driven cancers, tend to be ovarian, breast. They are feminine wounding. This is archetypal feminine healing that needs to happen. And the more you can surround yourself with positive, empowered feminine energy, the healthier your femaleness will be. And vice versa, if it's masculinity, if it's the sort of prostate cancers that are running in the family, same. Surrounding yourself with conscious archetypes of strong energies about this empowers healing throughout the lineage. And that's a kind of meta explanation. And the other reality is, and this is the more difficult one, is yes, it might happen. And running around spending your life trying to escape your genetics is probably a waste of time. It's a waste of energy. What the true essence of things of life, I believe, is it shouldn't be that you have to control everything that happens to you. It's that you create that center of health within you, health on every level, by the way, not just physically, but also, emotionally. Stability is healthy. But creating that level of acceptance so that you know that if your genetics do, quote unquote, get the better of you almost, you have a strategy, you know what you're going to do, and plan it. Plan your coping strategy of what you want to do should that day happen, because then almost everything we've been speaking about from the moment we started talking doesn't happen, because you're actually walking into that first potential diagnostic appointment with a clear roadmap. And usually when you get to plan it ahead of time, you leverage all of the broader solutions. So people like me, people who are going to talk about nutrition and juicing and green vegetables and broccoli from day one, you don't step into panic stations. You just, it's okay, that happened. Now what we're going to do? And you've already got the roadmap written. And if you want help doing that from professionals, we're always happy to help. Technically, functional medicine was always sold as preventative medicine.
Right.
The reality with modern is that everybody already has a chronic illness, so we've not got to the stage where we can help anybody prevent anything, unless you're kind of a life optimizer, health optimization, biohacker type of person. But preventative strategies and having a plan for should that thing happen is always something that people like myself are more than happy to help with. It tends to be very individual. It has to be individual at that point, because it depends on your age, your life situation, your support structures, etc. And it's almost like thinking of having a will or a funeral plan or all of those future planning things. And the reason this helps is because it just decreases fear and tension all the time.
Yeah,
and anything that remove those stresses, great, it's healthy.
Wow, so a lot of great advice, Victoria. I mean, brilliant, very pragmatic, very much based on your own experience. I mean, really great. I heard running through that some sort of key sort of themes recurring. Do you want to just quickly summarise the most important points that you've said today? Because I think there are a few that you could apply to almost all the questions that I asked you.
Sure, I think, from my perspective, not running everything from fear is the major theme of everything that I do, actually, whether I'm talking about cancer or life or every situation. And But I also will stress that it's not going to be possible. So the second theme is really have the right professionals around you and feel free to change those professionals at times. And we're not in this alone. And it's getting the right external support, advice, counselling. Don't feel like you're doing this on your own, but don't always expect your key caregiver within cancer care to be the person that you can ask every question to.
Right.
So not running from fear, not running these fear programs, and absolutely everything that can help you just change your frequency and your state from panic, stress, sympathetic, alertness, fight or flight to, okay, we're breathing, rest and digest, kind of let's receive energy, all of that kind of stuff. Those behaviors, those kind of things that you can do to change your state will be helpful all the way along.
Absolutely brilliant. Okay. Thanks so much, Victoria. We're going to have to leave it there. I always love talking to you. It's such a mine of great information and advice. Thank you very much.
No, thank you. It's such a pleasure to speak to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I imagine many of you will want to hear more about Victoria after listening to her excellent advice. The place to look is her website, which is victoriafenton.net, where you can read more about her and the services she offers. You can watch video presentations, you can listen to podcasts, and much, much more. Thanks a lot for listening today. Next week, I shall be back with another great guest for you, so I hope you'll want to listen again. Same time, same place, the Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.